Hi everyone, my name is Alex, and you're listening to the CDTM Mostly Awesome podcast. I'm here with my co-host Ali, and in this episode, we are talking to Thomas Kirchner. Thomas is an entrepreneur and founder of ProGlove, a company that sells smart gloves used in countless German and international companies for speeding up the manufacturing process. The idea for ProGlove is simple, yet brilliant. Every time you scan a barcode of a part when you assemble, for example, a car, you have to pick up a scanner from your pocket, scan the barcode of the item, and put back the scanner in your pocket. This is frustrating and time-consuming. So what if you could just wear the scanner? In this episode, we talked to Thomas about his life, his previous ventures, how he and his co-founders came up with the idea, how they scaled up the company from zero to millions in revenue, how they sold it for lots of money, now he's now giving back to other founders. Stay with us because you're not going to want to miss this episode. This is the CDTM Mostly Awesome podcast.
Thomas, we know all about you as the CEO and the co-founder of ProGlove, but maybe you can tell us a bit more about where you come from and your early days.
So first of all, thanks for having me. Where I come from? I'm originally from East Germany, so from near Dresden. Basically, if you draw a line between Berlin and Dresden, exactly on the border between Saxony and Brandenburg, that's where I grew up. I went to school, to a boarding school actually near Dresden. And then I did my Abitur there, so my high school degree. And after that, I did go, because I'm that old, I had to go to the military service. So I did my military service actually in Berlin. And then I started in Munich.
What brought you to Munich?
So I actually had a spot to study in Aachen for mechanical engineering, in Munich for mechanical engineering, and in Freiburg for history. And I was between doing something with math and physics, because I'm good at that, so mechanical engineering, or doing history. And then during the holidays, during my military service, I basically went to all the three cities. So I spent there one day in Aachen, one day in Freiburg, and one day in Munich. And I liked Munich the most. It's a beautiful city. I didn't talk to anyone, but it's a very beautiful city. And that's based on that, I made my decision. That's why I studied mechanical engineering.
Oh, that's pretty cool. Yeah. Nice. And you also mentioned that you come from a background which is not that entrepreneurial. What was your first touch point with entrepreneurship?
So my background is not entrepreneurial at all. Because I'm that old, again, I'm coming from East Germany. And not a lot of entrepreneurship happening in East Germany, or was happening then. Today is a little bit different. So most of my families actually work in one big steel mill. So also the little town I'm from. At that time, there were kind of 20,000 people living there, 10,000 of them working in one big steel mill. So this city was only steel. And also all of my relatives basically worked, all of my male relatives worked there. So both of my grandpas, my dad, my uncle, now still my cousin still works there. And they basically... They all worked in a big, it's a smithery, and in German it's a Schmiede, really big, so talking about 50 tons of glowing metal, and they're doing stuff like this. And I think the only contact point to entrepreneurship I had was that the best friend of my mom is a primary school teacher, the best friend of my mom, they had their own... What's Fleischerei?
Like a butcher or...
A butcher, yeah. They had their own butchery. And I think that's the kind of entrepreneurship I knew. And so really until I studied in Munich, I didn't know that you actually can found a company. I just didn't know. So my mom was very clear that I would work either in a steel mill or I will become a teacher. That was the two trajectories I was on. So my real first touch point with entrepreneurship was actually at university here in Munich.
Mm-hmm. So how did that get started? Did you do any courses related to entrepreneurship, or what was like the initial touch point at university?
I think the initial touch point was actually at Unternehmertum, Management. as CTM, you maybe know Manchamore, kind of similar program. And I think, I mean, I started studying in 2006, I think. And so also Unternehmertum was maybe 2 years old or so. And also Manchamore was really young. And I think I was in my third semester. So really doing mechanical engineering for the first two semesters, really sitting in one big room with 1,000 people doing math one, stuff like this. And then I just heard of this program and I joined in generation 7. Mm-hmm. I think today they are generation 42, something like this. So this was my really first contact point.
Mm-hmm. And can you also describe how that experience that you had at Manchamore and also with Unternehmertum in general, how that led you to found your first venture, and what was your first venture?
I think so. I mean, the program, again, very similar to CDTM, it's over three semesters. And the goal at Manchamore is to found your own startup in your third semester at Manchamore. That was the goal. And if they tell me I had to do it, I'm doing it. So I think that the first thing where I thought, okay, that's cool, that's different, is we did a lot of design thinking. So working with post-its, interviews, prototyping. So I learned this process or this approach actually at that time at Unternehmertum. And I really had fun and had in the first and second semester really interesting projects, both industry projects, so where the topic came from outside. And then the third semester was there to basically do your own project. And it was my project was a little green stamp for posting services that was CO2 neutral. And today everyone has this, so everything you send with Deutsche Post or DHL is CO2 neutral, but at that time it wasn't. So we wanted to basically do a little envelope that is CO2 neutral. That was my first entrepreneurial project. And I found a team and we worked on that and we stopped it after 6 months because it didn't work, but we worked on something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then pretty soon you founded another company. I think it was 2008, right? Or like somewhere around that time, that focused on electronics. Can you go into that?
So that was a little bit later. Mm-hmm. I did the entrepreneurial summer school. That was at that, I don't think it exists anymore today, but it was something between all the universities in Munich. So LMU, TU, University of Applied Science, and the Bundeswehr University. And it was for two weeks, and it was about, again, green energy, CO2, stuff like this. And by chance, and randomly, I ended up in a team with Paul. And Paul is also my co-founder now at ProGlove. So randomly, we connected working in these 2 weeks. And after these 2 weeks, we said, we're going to do something. And we had an idea, and we basically wanted to do, you still know Manufaktum, this where you can buy all the old stuff that is shiny. And so that was a big trend at that time. And we wanted to be the Manufaktum for green electronics. Mm-hmm. That was the vision.
Okay.
And ended up to be just an online store with basically wooden electronics and little solar panels, stuff like this. I think we did this for a year or so, maybe. But already at that time, it was really fun. And I like commitment. So I did this full time and I basically stopped studying. So I told my mom, I'm going to do this now. Mechanical engineering is boring. So I started this and I did it a year. We were three people, Paul, me, and one other person. And after a year, Paul and me decided, nah, it's not. So it didn't work a lot. And we had some customers, not a lot of customers. So we basically said to the third person, hey, if you want to continue doing this, have fun with it, and we are out. We want to do something different.
Mm. Did they continue it?
Yeah, and he continued it, and I think it's still online, and so it's now 15 years later, and I think today it's not making any money anymore, but for a time that he had five or six employees, and he was making money with it.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't own anything of that, so it's his success, but we started with him, and yeah.
Going back to your comment you made about design thinking, that you picked it up during your time at Manchamore. And I also see a lot of post-its around your office. So you clearly kept it with you. You also started a design consultancy, right? That focused on design thinking. Can you maybe tell a bit more about that?
I think that happens a lot if you learn design thinking. So first of all, design thinking is a cool process. And it's the, I think, the best process and the best approach to get from a challenge to a product very quickly. And you kind of have a recipe what to do. So that's why design thinking is actually cool for entrepreneurship education. And then you use it in entrepreneurship education for students like you and me. I did it. Then, of course, you try your own products. They maybe don't work. And then the other thing you learned is the process. And then, of course, the thing is, okay, then I'm selling the process. I'm going to be a design thinking consultant because you need money to buy food. And I think you also see that, you see that here in Munich, but also at the HPI, the Hasso-Plattner Institute in Berlin. Mm-hmm. I think half of the people coming out of their courses are becoming design thinking consultants. And also at that time, design thinking was a big, big hype and you could make money with that. So that's why we did some design thinking consultancy. But it had also to do with Alex, so the third or the next co-founder here at Prograph. So as I said, I did my Schumacher, then I founded something, did work out, and then I stopped studying. And then I was very bored, so I looked for a program similar to my Schumacher. And I ended up doing APE at the Hochschule München, so at the University of Applied Science. And it's, again, kind of the same. But one of the coaches there was Alex. And Alex was, before that time, actually, he was the managing director of IDEO. I think IDEO Germany. And IDEO is the company who invented design thinking. And Alex also was in the room when they named the process design thinking. Because design thinking, the name is not that old. The process itself is 50 years old. But the name is kind of new, or at least at that time. And so I connected a lot with Alex. And Alex is today one of my co-hosts at Prograph, one of my best friends, and actually was my flatmate for almost 10 years. So I did a very deep dive in design thinking. And together with him, we did some entrepreneurial projects. And always, if we ran out of money, we basically said, okay, we have to earn some money with design thinking consultancy. And we could do that. That was kind of our cheat because of Alex, because he was the IDEO guy. And so we can sell stuff. And I was basically, he was selling it, I was doing it. And so always if we ran out of money with our entrepreneurial project, we could cheat and earn some money with this, I think, stuff.
What kinds of clients did you work with then? Like, and how does the process look like, just as for the listeners that maybe don't know?
Mm-hmm. So design thinking itself is kind of innovation process. And the short summary is basically, you have a challenge, you go out and do lots of interviews without thinking about your solution. And then you come back, try to do lots of ideas and prototypes. And then you go out again and test these prototypes and iterate. And for someone who doesn't know design thinking, it sounds like, yeah, okay, that's what you do. It's kind of as an entrepreneur, you see things and you build stuff and you test it. So it seems straightforward. But again, for people who are not used to work like this, it's a cool process to learn it first. So to have this recipe and you have methods of first do this and then this and then this. And when we did design consultancy work, mostly it was in education. So big companies, so big European banks or big really DAX companies basically booked Alex and me to teach design thinking to their employees. I'm not allowed to say the names. But just DAX mm-hmm. companies, yeah.
So that would be to develop some internal products at these companies then?
Yeah. So basically to get their innovation department or their engineering department to get to develop better products. And we did lots of design thinking with them together.
And now we come to Prograph. And also for the listeners who don't know what exactly Prograph does, can you maybe explain it in a few sentences?
Sure. And I have it here in front of me. I know it's a podcast, but we always have our product with us. So it's a smart glove that makes the worker in manufacturing and logistics more efficient. So if you work at an assembly line, for example, at BMW, you have to scan all your things with a scan pistol at the moment. So you're taking a scan pistol, scanning something, looking at the screen, it's the right part, bring back your scan pistol, and then you can build in the part. And basically what we did, we built the scan pistol into a glove so you can directly scan something that saves you 3 to 4 seconds per scan, but because you have to scan roughly 1,000 times per car and you are building roughly 1,000 cars a day, it's 1,000 times 1,000 times 3 to 4 seconds. Mm-hmm. That's why they like us.
Mm-hmm. And how did you come to this idea?
Actually, it wasn't my idea. It was Paul's idea, Paul's idea, or the original thing. And it was, again, we as a team. So I did something together with Alex, and then we have Jonas, the other co-founder at ProGlove. We already worked on a product, and we got Paul into that product because it was about hardware. And then just Paul saw, hey, there is a big competition out there from Intel, and it was called Make It Wearable. And at that time, today the big hype is generative AI. At that time, it was wearables. So the competition was called Make It Wearable. Today it would be Make It Generative AI. And in that competition, you could win. First prize was, I think, $500,000 from Intel. And just because of that, hey, you can win $500,000. Let's do something. So Paul came one evening, said, hey, there's this competition. Let's put something in there. I have an idea for a glove. Let's do that. So there was a deadline Sunday evening. Typically, Paul Manner, he came on a Friday evening. I had something to do on the weekend, so I said, no, I don't want to do it. But Jonas had time, so they prepared something. So the first entry actually was by Jonas and Paul with the idea of a smart glove. Mm-hmm. And Paul came to this idea because Paul worked at BMW at that time, mm-hmm. but not in a fancy job. He was a tour guide for the manufacturing plant. And this was his way to earn money during his studies. And then there was this this competition about wearables. And then, of course, okay, everyone is building wearables for the consumer market. What if we would build a wearable for BMW? Oh, that's interesting. And that was the challenge we took, basically. Let's build a wearable for the industry. And then glove was kind of the first idea.
Mm-hmm. So you had this initial idea that you submitted, and then you were selected for the final of the competition, which was in Las Vegas, or?
I think there was two or three stages between that, and we had an online pitch and stuff like this. And then at the end, we were invited to San Francisco. This was the final. These were 10 companies. But also in these 10 companies, we were the only one doing something B2B. All the other 9 were doing some B2C stuff.
Why do you think that is? Was it because it was shinier to do like a B2C product, or?
I think it was more obvious. So again, wearables was the hype at that time. And everyone thought about fitness tracker, and there was some baby stuff in there. But no one had the access to BMW, for example. And then we came, basically, and it was a worldwide contest. And then we came in, and then the Germans, they invented something to build cars even faster. Yeah, so it was also a fitting story.
And what did the first prototype for ProGlove look like? And how did it evolve over time?
I have it here.
Uh-huh. Can you also describe it?
So that's the first prototype we ever built. As you see, it's a fancy looking glove with a display, and this display is an old iPod. So we basically glued an old iPod on a glove, and then we ran a PDF on that iPod showing different features that it could have. And then with that thing, we did go out to customers and ask them, hey, we invented a smart glove. What would you do with it? So, and I think that's always the process. You have an idea, and at the beginning, you have a form factor, kind of smart glove, and then you think about 40 features that it could have. And with this vision of a smart glove, 40 features, can do anything in logistics and manufacturing, we actually won this competition. And then the hard part is to figure out what is the one feature people are actually willing to pay for. Mm-hmm. And that's what we had at the end, but it was 6 months later, was basically what we're doing today. It's a scanning glove.
Yeah. How did you figure that out? Like this one feature that people really want and won't pay for?
I think it's a lot, again, design thinking. Iterating prototyping. So we built hundreds of prototypes, did go out and talk to people. And the cool thing is, because of the competition, so we won the third prize and we got some money. And overall, we won $250,000. 150 were prize money, so we could do whatever we want with that. The other 100 were convertible loan. But we had that money, 250. And then we basically went back to Munich and said, okay, they gave us so much money, let's try this. And we hired some people, hired all friends of us that didn't have a job at that time. So we gave them some money to work with us, not for us, with us. And then I think we were a team of roughly 8 to 10 people. And with these 8 to 10 people for 6 months, we built prototypes, we tested, we did go out to customers, try to sell pilot projects. So the typical first steps of what you try to do. And during that process, we iterated to, okay, we had one version. There were lots of features and it already had the scanner, but also a little wristband with lots of other features. And then one customer said to us, so, okay, guys, I don't need the wristband, but the scanner, I would pay for the scanner. And so basically in that meeting, then and after that meeting, we decided, okay, let's see what happens if we just build a scanner. And it's by chance, it was the customer wanted it. We as a team were able to build it. And you can actually, it's an interesting market. You can grow fast and you can make money with that. So by luck, we found that. And so still the success of the company today, 10 years later, is still this one idea. Let's put a scanner on a glove.
Mm-hmm. So then you came up with the initial idea and then it's about kind of getting more commitment from the customers, I guess. How did you go about that? How do you secure that commitment or, you know, the letters of intent or things like that?
Yeah. So also what we tell every young B2B company, but also B2C, but you need traction. So that the one thing investors want most is to see the proof this thing works. So everyone can have a good idea and a good pitch deck, but they want to see proof. They want to believe you. You just have to give them some things that they can believe you. And in our case, it was pilot project. So we did go to BMW and basically said to them, hey, we have this idea and we want to test it with you. But we don't have a lot of these, so you have to pay for our tests. And also you can give feedback and help us. So we basically sold them pilot projects where we could test. We would have paid for that chance to test, but somehow we got them to pay us so we could test. And we did these pilot projects with 10 different companies, lots of automotive companies, but also other big German manufacturing companies. Mm-hmm. And the simple thing was, they completely got the product from the beginning because it's a very easy return on investment case. It's saving this amount of money, this amount of time. So let's put it in a model. How much money can we save here? What's the investment cost? So you can kind of calculate an ROI thing within 2 days, more or less, just a little testing. And every one of them saw, okay, I want to have this. So I'm going to support these guys. Because we were very open, hey, we need these pilot projects. If we don't have any pilot projects, we can't convince our investors to give us money, and we need the money to go into production. So at that point, we only had prototypes. We didn't have the real product. So we also told BMW, if you don't give us a pilot project, you're not going to see the product at all because we need investors first.
So you kind of bootstrapped it a little bit through these pilot projects as well then? Or
I mean, we had these $250,000 from Intel. I think we were very money efficient compared to other startups we see, but I wouldn't call it bootstrapped. I know bootstrapped startups, it's a different thing.
There's a legend that you guys were so much at the shop floor of the companies that they had to give you employee eggs or something.
Yeah, the BMW guys. So yeah. They were so just here in the BMW factory here in Munich, we basically tested every week. And the people at the gate were really annoyed that we are coming every week because lots of paperwork every week. And then very quickly, they had a process that we can actually give employee passes. And I think we still have them. So we got 5 or so. So every time, I think they're valid for whole Europe. So still, if we wanted to, we can get into every BMW factory in Europe with these employee passes, just because they were so annoyed from us testing every week. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Can you also maybe describe now that ProGlob has grown so much? How did you finance the journey?
Sorry, what?
How did you finance that journey after the current ticket?
So first of all, so I've been the CEO for the first 4 years. Then we made a role change. But in the first 4 years, we had these 250 kind of seed from the competition. In that, so as I said, in the competition was also a convertible loan from Intel. And then we got another small convertible loan from a family office. And then we raised our first 2 million round. So the competition was end of 2014. And the first 2 million round was April of 16, so roughly 1 year later, a little bit more than 1 year. And this was, again, from Intel, from this family office, and from Bayern Capital. So Bayern Capital here in Bavaria is the kind of the state fund, and they are always mirroring private rounds. So that was our first round, and it was a really hard time. So no one wanted invest in us. Also, we did go to all the Munich investors, all the names you probably know. Everyone said no. They had fear for hardware, so they didn't want to do hardware stuff. Most of them are software investors, and they can't handle hardware. It has some risks. And also, they always said, oh, someone from Asia will come and will just copy it. Okay. So we had at the end, because we had two US investors, so Intel and the family office, and they basically said, hey, we want you to have another lead investor here in Europe that can be closer to you. And we were not able to find one. So at the end, they said, okay, then we are going to do the lead. But we didn't find any investors. Most of the investors that we talked to, maybe 2 weeks after the exit, wrote us emails. Oh, we are so sorry that we didn't invest. So, so that was the first round. And then, and we are very proud of that. So with this 2 million, we got into production. We introduced the product 3 months later in summer of 16. And we already made 1 million in revenue in 16. We made 4 million revenue in 17 and kind of doubled after that always. And exactly these are the numbers we wrote down in our business plan during the financing round. And also our investor said, it's unheard of. A startup that writes down the numbers and can actually do it. And because these were US investors, they were the Germans. Mm-hmm. If they write down a number, they mean it.
But so you were raising this initial round when you already had traction through these pilot projects?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how was this transition for you personally? Like going more from this product guy who's developing and more towards this management that you mentioned as a CEO?
I think at this point of time, so during the financing rounds, it was fine. It felt like a big team. And also, even if I was the CEO, I had a team of my co-founders. So we were basically four people doing the management thing, and we were a team. And everyone had a specific role. But it didn't felt like, okay, I'm the only one who's deciding something here. It was really a team effort. But specifically the financing rounds, I was annoyed by that. I don't like financing rounds. I don't like talking to 100 people and then them saying no to me without really understanding what they are talking about. Yeah. So that was annoying. But we got the company. We had our second financing round was then with, I think, 4 or 5 million, something like this. Again, we had a really hard time finding investors. So despite having this 1 million revenue and then 4 million revenue, it was really hard to convince investors. Nobody wanted to invest in ProGraph.
Why is that?
It was, I think it was again hardware, and people didn't believe in this scaling hardware thing.
But was it also this defensibility concern that there could be some cheap manufacturer from China? And like, how did you resolve that? Was there any trick that you used?
Well, we didn't do any tricks. We just built a product.
So you didn't patent it or anything?
Yeah. So of course we have some patents, but the patents are valuable now. So 8 years later. And the patents weren't that valuable in the first 2 years. Mm-hmm. And so all the fears they had that someone will copy it immediately and there was the price will fall down very, very hardly, nothing of that happened.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so fortunately, we found actually one investor here in Munich, and they are called DIVC, so D-I-V-C. Small investor, but the head of that investment group is very, very experienced, so we really like him. So he invested, and we had this 5 million round. And during that round, because it was, again, a very hard round, where me as CEO, it was my task, and we were running out of money slowly, and you can't sleep anymore, because you know, if I don't get it closed soon, this we're just going to stop doing this here, or we have to let down all the people, and yeah. And I think during that financing round, I already said, I'm not going to do the next one. That's not, I don't want to do that. And I think after that round, I still stayed for a while. And then we were roughly 100 people. And then together as a founding team, we made a decision, okay, getting the company to roughly 10 million revenue. We did that, check. But growing a company from 10 million revenue to 100 million revenue, no idea how to do that. And I think that's where we made the decision, hey, we have to get really experienced outside management in and see what happens. And I was basically the first to do this. And I did go to our investors and basically told them, hey, if we want next phase CEO, should be me. should be something, someone who's more experienced. The investors were like, no, you're doing a great job, you're going to stay there. No. And then, but what they gave me was very experienced chairman of the board.
Mm-hmm.
So they basically said, okay, let me help you. He's a very experienced chairman of the board. It was Andreas König from TeamViewer.
Mm-hmm.
I really like Andreas. I believe he's a very bad board member because he can't let go. That's why we very quickly asked him, okay, so more out of a joke, so I don't want to be CEO anymore. You want to be CEO?
Yeah.
And he said, okay, that's how we found our CEO.
Mm-hmm.
So I was there for 4 years and then Andreas took over. He was the CEO of TeamViewer, and before TeamViewer, he was part of a bigger US startup and was responsible for the European business and was responsible for $2 billion in revenue. So completely overqualified for what we are doing here, but he wanted to do it. I think he was bored. And then Andreas took over, and then he basically, with him, started the bringing out more outside management, and he shuffled around us founders all in a little bit of different role. Yeah, but since then, I'm in a different role.
Mm-hmm. But going back a little bit to 2016, you had this prototype, and then at some point you had to scale up production. How did you go about that, and like what were some of the challenges that you faced? Because I suppose you had to bring in like a lot of hardware equipment, come up with the production line and everything. How was that like?
Again, it's not that hard. So always people think hardware is hard, but it's not. So we have Consti was our first intern, and by now we gave him the title of co-founder. So he's here now from the beginning, and he's still responsible for the production. And maybe he's a magician, but he just did it. Mm-hmm. So he planned all the production. I think all the first products and prototypes we built out on our own. You saw it here in the office. We like to build stuff on our own. Mm-hmm. And also I explained to you the heat press process.
Mm-hmm.
And the first prototypes we built was actually with an iron. Mm-hmm. So I think from Consti's mom. Oh. And also that was when we made the 2 million pitching. This was one of the production equipment we showed to our investors. And they were like, you can't do it like this. Yes, we can. But it worked. So I think if you have this spirit of building stuff on your own and just do it yourself and getting it done, you don't need a lot of money. But we just built equipment. We bought equipment from the do-it-yourself store. We just did it. And I think very cost efficiently. So you don't have a big scale. So it was step by step by step. So it never felt like there's this huge challenge we have to overcome now. Of course, there are always small challenges. We had problems with our housing. We had battery problems. But it's all stuff that comes in and, okay, let's solve it. And then we solved it.
So for the first 6 years, you actually produced in Germany.
Yeah.
Can you talk about like what were some of the initial challenges with that? Or was it like, what was the initial problem, and then kind of how did that develop also over time? And then at some point you had to move over to another country. Can you then also talk about the transition?
So of course the first prototypes we built on our own in our office, also our first office, we were part of Tech Founders at Unternehmertum, and then we could go into the makerspace. So our first prototypes we actually built in Garching at the makerspace. And then when we, I think, did go into bigger batches, we just thought, okay, we need a supplier who can do that for us. And one of the most prolific here in or around Munich is TQ Systems. They do hardware production. And I think all hardware startups in Munich, at one time or another, have been at TQ or talked to TQ. So also Tado, I think we got the tip from Tado, the heating startup, that they produced at TQ, and TQ sits at Ammersee. And I think a very important factor at the beginning, if you want to produce hardware, is that you have to be very close to your production facility, because stuff is not going to work out. So there's lots of small problems, and then you have to sit in your car, go for an hour to your production site and look at it and trying to solve it. And so the alternative is producing in Asia. It's a black box. So you're ordering something, and then 3 months later, you're getting something. You open up the box, and you're hoping if it's going to work. And so it was very important to be close to that production facility and solving small problems from on a day-to-day basis. So that's why we produced in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And we produced TQ for the first 6 years and we were very happy with them. But then we just outgrew them. There comes a time in hardware where just the numbers get bigger and then you want to, of course, push the prices a little. And then we changed to Hungary. But it was in year six. So for the first 6 years, Germany was completely perfect for us.
Nice.
But also, I think that's the pro for B2B hardware. So selling hardware to BMW is something different than selling hardware to consumer. The margins are very different. And we have higher margins than Apple. We're very proud of that. But because you have this kind of wiggle room in the margins, you can also have this luxury to produce in Germany because it's about quality and not about every cent. And if you have a consumer product, it's more about the cents. And then maybe you have to go to Asia because you can't produce it for that price in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a little bit the pro for B2B hardware.
Yeah. Talking now a bit more about the company culture. One thing that I noticed when I walked in is this crappiness, like everyone is doing projects and you have this motto of build, build, build. How would you perceive the culture at ProGlove? And was it that way from day one or did you consciously decide?
I think the culture, and it's true for every startup company, the culture for the first few years is basically the personalities of the founders.
Mm-hmm.
And because you are here and you are communicating all the time, so all the things that kind of become a culture is heavily personality-based of the founders. And if you look into our founding group, you see exactly the stuff we're doing here. We have design thinking. I brought it in, and also Alex, so basically everyone brought in design thinking, lots of post-its. Then we have this prototyping. So Paul is our crazy prototyper. He can basically build everything within a day. And also the first employees we had, our industrial designer, they are building stuff. And because these were our first employees, they did this whole day. And then, of course, they also hired other people that are like this. So then we have this money efficiency. So Jonas and Manuel are very money efficient. They're very German project managers, planning stuff. So you see that here at ProGlove. You're seeing lots of stupid stuff just because we like to have fun working. So all the culture you see here is basically us founders and our first 10 people team. And just the personality of us put into a culture. And then at a later point of time, we wrote it down. And of course, we have 5 guiding principles, something like this. But still, one of the core guiding principles is prototyping. And I still do the onboarding. So all new employees that come in, besides HR, the first face they see is my face. And I say hello to them and I explain to them the company culture. And I always say, if you only remember one thing out of this session, let it be prototyping. That's the core thing.
And I also noticed when I was walking to the corridor, this museum of faces. Anyone to tell what it is?
So we had a very boring hallway, and during Corona, we were just bored, and someone had the idea to build a little museum. So on the one side, you have basically very famous artworks with ProGlove inside. So there's a Mona Lisa wearing a ProGlove, and there's Napoleon wearing a ProGlove, stuff like this. And on the other side, these historic portraits of employees. So every employee who is here more than 5 years can kind of order an historic portrait. So you just have an artist and digital artist out there that does that for us. And you just order some kind of portrait you see that has already been done, and then they put your face into that. And it's really so you see lots of employees as generals and lots of employees at queens. So I think we have 2 or 3 queens there. It's always fun.
Very original, yeah.
Then you already alluded a little bit to the transition phase where you stepped down as the CEO. Can you talk a little bit more about how that went and whether there were any kind of culture clashes between like someone coming in who was like more used to managing like a bigger company, like a more mature enterprise, and how did that work out?
So as I said before, we had this kind of in-between step of Andreas being the chairman of the board. So people all around here already knew him as chairman of the board, and they weren't suspicious when he was here and when he was more here. So this transition phase of also the preparation of, hey, there's going to be a new CEO, was very smooth because people already knew, okay, that's Andreas, he's the chairman of the board. And of course, he's hanging around with Thomas and the founders because he's chairman of the board. And then there was just one meeting that we, so not an emergency meeting, but all hands meeting, actually here in the kitchen, where it's only me and Andreas on stage, where I was basically saying to everyone, okay, we have a new CEO now. It's Andreas. Andreas. And then he started talking. And everyone, so the employees were really, really surprised. They didn't expect that. But that wasn't a big problem. They were just surprised. But also everyone were like, really? This guy wants to be CEO? He's overqualified. So they were really happy with Andreas. They already knew him a little. They knew his face. They knew what he's done. And I think one key thing at the beginning, and it's, of course, he was used to bigger companies, but was that he was hanging around with us founders a lot. So I think for the first months, there was always a founder with him in every meeting. So also the people saw, okay, they are very close. And also he worked with us very close. We are still very good friends. Andreas by now is retired, but we were just, the founder group were just having dinner with him at his house. So very nice. So we were very close to him, always talking to him. And always, and that was very important to us, he was the CEO now. So he had 100% of our support. Of course, in a room with just founders and CEO, we discussed stuff and also we said, Andreas, we can't do that, that's stupid. But outside of a meeting room, whatever Andreas said was the right thing because we are here as founders now to support the CEO. That was very, very important. And also, but Andreas fits very well to us. So he's also a hands-on guy. He studied mechanical engineering. So he likes to build stuff. He was also always prototyping. But actually, he's a sales CEO. And that was very important for our organization. For the first few years, it was kind of product-led. So every one of us thought about product and product market fit. And then we had product market fit. And it was about scaling. And then we had Andreas. And Andreas is sales-led, kind of. So the product was still in our hands, in us founders' hands. And Andreas was now kind of building the sales machinery. And also, we are not good as sales. So that we said, yeah, do your thing. And so I can't remember really big culture clashes with Andreas. I don't think so.
Okay, so about the exit of the company after you kind of grew the company and then you hired your new CEO, then he kind of grew it even more. At some point, you came to the point where you decided it was time to exit. What was that like? Can you talk about the general procedure of how that happens and then also kind of how it worked out for you?
So in general, if you go the VC route, so if you raise money for a venture capitalist, unfortunately, they want their money back. So, you know, you have to do an exit, some kind of an exit. And we weren't big enough to do a big IPO. There was at that time, there was SPACs going around, or SPACs, and that's bullshit, I would say. And basically, it wasn't the decision of us founders. It was basically our CEO, because that's also his job. He's responsible for shareholder value. And he was just observing, hey, the valuations in 21, 22 were really high. So he made a decision. I think we should start a process because valuations are really high. And I don't want to raise another round or trying to sell the company when valuations are down again. So let's use this kind of window of opportunity to do it. And I'm very thankful for him. So he came to us and said he believes, gut feeling, this is the right time. He would like to start that. And we said, okay. Because he's much more experienced. So, but the input came from him. And also it didn't come from the investors. It came from our CEO. And then Andreas, we basically talked to the big investment banks and ended up with Goldman Sachs. Crazy people. But they helped us a lot. So I think the whole process, so all the preparation, all the talks internally until the end of the process were roughly a year. And I think we had our exit in May 22. Mm-hmm. At the end, so Goldman Sachs was head of the process. And then you have lots of presentations, of course, all the interested parties. And it was very clear that we are going either a strategic buyer would buy us, so one of our big competitors, or some investment company.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing is, and I only understood it at that time, that people who buy you at that point of time that are not strategic are also just investors. They had basically, they have the same business model like a VC. They are just investing later and they are not expecting a 10x return. They are expecting a 3x return. But it's the same thing. It's just mm-hmm. a little bit later. And then also I got that in the process is if you go with a strategic buyer, of course, they would like to integrate you and maybe they would say, okay, you have 200 salespeople, but we have salespeople already, so we can let go all the salespeople. So they're buying a product. But if you go with an investor, it kind of the company stays the same. It's just the shareholder changes because he's the investor. And of course, you have the same pressure with the VC. You have to grow because they want to achieve their return. But it felt very, okay, it's the same thing. So we talked to a lot of them. And then the private equity firms made some offers. And we decided in the end for Nordic Capital. It's a private equity firm from Sweden.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very nice people. Also very chill people, they're Swedish. So we really liked them from the beginning. They made a good offer. And then that was also surprising to me as a founder. The process led by Goldman Sachs, it was very short in time then. So you had your last offers. And then from the last offers to the appointment at the notary, I think it was 10 days. So they really pushed that through. And I think we said, the day of the notary, we sat at the notary office. We were scheduled to start at 11 in the morning. At the end, we started at 9 or 10 p.m. And I think I was there together with Andreas, our CEO. And I think we did go home at 4 or 5 in the morning then. That was an interesting process. But otherwise, it's similar to investment round, a little bit different, but very similar. But again, and we had luck. So we had a very high valuation because of the timing we had. So the whole idea of this, hey, there's this window of opportunity, as our CEO said. So I can't talk about the exact numbers, but in the press, it says we had a 500 million exit. So high valuation. And it really worked out. So he had a gut feeling 1 year earlier. We did go through the process, worked. And it's really, we were very proud of that because if you look in a textbook and you look into a tech startup, you always see the 7-8 year investment thing. So pre-seed, blah, blah, blah. And Proglove is really, I think, 8 years. So it's really textbook,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
2 or 3 investment rounds and then a really high exit bought by a private equity firm. And then, of course, we talked about our struggle to get investors at the beginning. And then, of course, this month after the exit, all the investors writing you as a founder, we missed out. We are so sorry. That feels good as a founder.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but that's roughly how the process went.
Mm-hmm. And so basically what you do is initially you contact some investment bank and then they shop for offers for you or like...
That's how we did it. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if this is the general process. I only did it once. Mm-hmm. But that's how they did it. So they did most of the process. And also they were very careful with who is going to allow to talk to the founders.
Mm-hmm.
So they were king of the process.
Mm-hmm.
At the end, and I was surprised about that. So they're very good at the process. They are still not good at explaining the product or doing the slides. So at the end, most of the slides we did. Also, we founders again did. And also most of the presentation, our management plus we founders. And also we built some fancy prototypes and showed them especially for that
mm-hmm.
presentations. Uh-huh. But Goldman Sachs, I was very surprised that they are really, really good at that process. And also, so people working at Goldman Sachs, if you send them a slide in the middle of the night, so 4 p.m. because you are done with your slide, there's someone at Goldman Sachs looking at that slide and basically reworking it until the morning at 8 a.m. Wow. So, yeah. So there's,
really
yeah, yeah, there's someone always working, doing it. And that's, I like that.
Now doing a full circle, because we started with your journey from Dresden. And from what I now heard was that you're now again involved a lot in Dresden. So you have this program that you set up. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Sure. So what we did after the exit. So we had our exit 1.5 years ago. Just again, as an explanation, the VCs all got their money and we founders sold half of our shares. So the company, 85% of the company belongs now to a new owner. It's a private equity company called Nordic Capital. And the other 50% still belongs to us founders. Mm-hmm. But because we had a very high valuation, also half of your shares is a lot of money. That's why we founded an NGO. In German, you say Stiftung, specifically for entrepreneurship education. So we put some €1 million aside saying, hey, we're going to push entrepreneurship education. And because I'm from Dresden, one of my goals was, hey, okay, it works in Munich. Why does it work in Munich? The thing is, so of course, Munich is a nice city and nice surrounding. But if you look into the entrepreneurship centers, 20 years ago, they are working because very rich individuals finance them. So the Unternehmertum is financed by Vorklatten. And it's not financed by Vorklatten anymore, maybe a little. But the first initial investment came from Vorklatten as the owner of BMW. And today, the Unternehmertum has 400 employees pushing entrepreneurship. Then you have the entrepreneurship center of the University of Applied Science in Munich, the Straschek Center. It's financed by Falk Straschek, also a very rich entrepreneur who did an exit. And I think the Straschek Center has roughly 50 employees. If you go, and these are only two entrepreneurship centers. We have, I think, two more in Munich. And if you go to Dresden, you have one entrepreneurship center responsible for all universities. And at this entrepreneurship center, they're working 10 people. Yeah. So it's about resources. And that's what we are basically trying to do, bringing these resources to Dresden and also the knowledge that we have. And one of the first things we do there is a program like Much More, like CTM. It's called Yeti, like the monster from the Himalaya. And it's a 3-semester program. We do design thinking. Goal is to own your own product in the 3rd semester, mm-hmm. Your own company. We are at the 3rd generation now. I'm taking in 15 to 20 students. And it's not so, the Technical University of Dresden is a very good technical university. Also, the other universities are good. So the students are the same. It's just no one is pushing them to found companies. Mm-hmm. And there should be as many companies in Dresden per student as in Munich. There's no reason why not. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just pushing that. And that's what we're doing right now.
So is it very similar to Manage & More? Is it like you start in the 3rd semester of your studies thereabouts, or like how does it work?
It's very similar to Manage & More. Also, I'm an entrepreneur. I'm not inventing new stuff. I'm copying stuff. If it works here in Munich, I'm copying the base concept. I'm tweaking it in some. For example, I'm also stealing from CTM. Very important, I think, is that you have the right people, the right process, but also the right place. And I know you have your CTM office, and I think it's a hub for you where you meet a lot. And so Matchmore doesn't have an office. So one of the first things I put in Dresden is we have our own office. Mm-hmm. So I stole that from CTM. So I'm tweaking it here and there. And of course, I'm kind of, you can call it localizing. So taking a business model and localizing it for Dresden. But otherwise, it's very similar. And the students are as bright as they are in Munich. It's just about pushing them.
Mm-hmm. Do you focus on a particular part of entrepreneurship, like more like hardware type products, or is it just general kind of entrepreneurial skills?
It's general. Everyone can do what they want. But of course, most of the input comes from me or from my ProGlove colleagues. They are basically also going there to Dresden every semester once at least. I think we are tending to push hardware, and also the first startups now coming out of the program or that have actually done revenue is a hardware startup. So mm-hmm. The first one.
Cool. Yeah.
But it's not on. It's just because we are doing hardware.
And you also, like, similar to Manage & More and CTM, you also have a management team, like people who take care of the program and do the everyday operational stuff.
So I have two employees from the Entrepreneurship Center in Dresden, plus me. So we are program management. And then we have, and I think it's the same as CTM, you have internal projects. So I have a hierarchy within the students. So I have semester leads and team leads and stuff like that. So you can actually train taking responsibility for a team, stuff like this.
Mm-hmm.
The cool thing for everyone out there, if you want to visit Dresden, Dresden was very rich roughly 120 years ago. So you have lots of very, very nice old buildings. And one of these nice old buildings is now the headquarters of Yeti. So that's the cool thing. The building we have is built in 1870, and it's really old villa.
Mm.
And it's very, very nice. And that's the thing where you here in Munich, we would say doesn't exist in Munich. Or we'd say, okay, there's some kind of embassy in there. And in Dresden, you have lots of buildings that are kind of empty that look like this. So if you want to come to Dresden, you can have entrepreneurship in a very nice building.
I actually saw the photo and it looks like Hogwarts.
Yeah. and it's the, so we looked at different offices. It's the cheapest one.
Thanks so much for being part of this. Thanks for doing this with us. And yeah, we usually towards the end, we ask kind of a random question that you might want to ask the next guest on the podcast. So whoever that might be, you can think of a general question.
Okay, and if you are an entrepreneur, if the next guest is an entrepreneur, why are you still in your role? Why are you not hiring someone that is better than you so you can do something else?
And then also coming back to that, we had a question from the previous guest, which was, if you would give advice to your younger self, what would it be?
Probably I would say, don't worry about it. So the older you get more relaxed. And most of the things most of the things feel worse than they are really, how they are really are. And there were probably phases for my younger self where I took stuff very seriously and it didn't help. So I would probably say, don't worry.
Mm-hmm. So have a more chill attitude.
Yeah, chill. Everything will be fine. Mm-hmm. Get over it.
That's a great note to end the podcast on. Thanks so much for doing this with us. And yeah, we'll see you in the next episode.
Cool. Thank you.
Thank you so much.